So it's with great pleasure that we have here today Professor Shinichi Nakagawa from the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia. Shinichi is a Renaissance man of sorts when it comes to topic areas, having worked on all sorts of wonderful things like mate choice and sexual selection and some terrible things like animal personality as well.
I'm not going to talk about it, unfortunately.
That's a real shame. but also, you know, some excellent, rigorous sort of statistical methods and a lot of meta-analysis stuff, which I believe you're going to focus on today.
Yeah, today.
And so certainly someone to chat with about any and all topics. I really encourage you to try and meet with Shinichi. There's still some time tomorrow, depending on merging and lunch plans and those sorts of things. Over to you, Shinichi.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, I'm very excited to be here. And you know, Alex gave me a tour of the facility. Oh my God, it's so good here. Yeah. So this talk, Love Story, there's quite a few jokes. I consider as jokes. I gave this like similar talk in Japan. Nobody laughed. But Germany is known for its sense of humor. So hopefully you enjoy it. So it's a love story. It comes in four parts. And then let me start from the taking you back to my PhD time, 2003 to 2007. And this is the place, Lundy Island, off the coast of Bristol. It's a small island, and about 200 sparrows in there. And it's sort of isolated. Young myself, very fit, checking out the egg. So I was a field biologist. I still am a field biologist. So I want to summarize my PhD by poem, which I actually wrote on the island toward the end of my PhD. Okay, the Latin name is Passa domesticus. Is that good? Okay. We love them because they live among us, and there's lots of sparrows around here as well. They sound like cheep cheep, but actually they're quite deep. And I'm going to skip about 240 lines because it's going to take forever. They have been shaped by millennia of evolution. I have given them 3 years of dedication, and they have given me their treasures in return. And these will make the scientific world turn. And this was the plan, but you know, that in reality, okay, should I stop? Yeah, in reality, most of my results are negative results. So there was no Nature or Science paper which would have, you know, turned really the scientific world turn. But that's hindsight, that was okay. So I'll tell you why it was okay. Full of negative results, then I came across the technique meta-analysis. So my PhD, let me explain. So this is the male sparrows has what we call budget status, that's supposed to be correlated with the status signaling, and that was well established, we thought, and my PhD was just checking out whether this correlates with paternal capability. Seems like it's a feasible hypothesis, you know, worthy of PhD, but I didn't find anything, yeah? Like there doesn't seem to be no correlation. I even like manipulated, experiment. So I thought, oh, this is no good. You know, I can't really publish this. I mean, now you can publish it, but back then it was difficult to publish negative effects. So what I did was I conducted meta-analysis. This is the what we call forest plot. How you read it, this is the, let me focus on this because this is other stuff. It's correlation between parental capability, you know, how often they come back to the nest and the size of batch size. And there was 8 other studies doing a similar sort of stuff from what I did. And I put it together, 95 confidence interval overlaps with 0, so it's inconclusive. And it was really good learning meta-analysis because meta-analysis, it highlights, you know, people found significant results, but you find the opposite, and you can see the overall picture. Yeah? And this is correlation coefficient. And another good thing, so this was a real treasure brought by the house sparrows. I met Inas Cuthill. He was actually, I mean, he still is a professor of animal behavior at Bristol University. He happened to come to the island, and we start talking about, you know, I thought about a lot, the effect size of those things, correlation, strength of effect. They're not necessarily correlated with statistical significance and all that. So I wrote this paper. This paper is well cited, but a couple of things I'm really proud of is now it's, if you search the effect size, and it's in Wikipedia, this is cited, that's one of the biggest achievements, scientific achievement. And this paper, I managed to put stupid in it. So it's not many, so we kind of say, oh, it would be so stupid to use p-value or something like this. Anyway, so that was that, and just I mentioned this recent paper, they updated the meta-analysis of this, and it's actually changes quite dramatically, but that's the talk for another day. And when I started meta-analysis, there was no method for the, because, you know, I was lucky enough to do meta-analysis on house sparrows, but most of the time, you know, that you are working on particular species and you are the only one to do so. Meta-analysis, what you want to do is you can sort of correlate all the different species to see the generality, right? And again, I was lucky enough, this man, Gerald Hadfield, have you heard of the R package called MCMC-GLMM? Maybe? So he's an author. And he happened to sit next to my future wife. So I got, I was visiting her quite a lot for during a courtship, and I get to know him very well. He was like bit of like a beta male and helped me courtship. But also, we got to write this nice paper. And this was like, not only the theory was around, but he really implemented the method for meta-analysis, controlling phylogeny, and this led to two things. One thing is like it's attracted lots of collaboration because people wanted to do meta-analysis, but controlling for the phylogeny, they wanted to do correctly. And also, I was able to, so every student worked on a different topic in animal behavior, but I got them to do meta-analysis as well. Here's some examples, extra paternity in passerines, something on the gross catch-up growth and cost of parental care. This is very different comparative analysis of chemical induced sex reversal and some metabolic rate stuff. So point to take from here is a meta-analysis. It doesn't matter what topic you are working on, you can certainly do meta-analysis on your topic. And this is actually, I wanted to show how my research looks like. So this is the whole field of science. So this is medicine. This is the biology, and about, I don't know, 48 topics I published. This is mathematics, engineering. Those are four main species I have worked on. But because of meta-analysis, I was able to invade the whole universe, yeah? And this is medicine, psychology, computational biology, and there's something for the young PhD student and postdocs. Really interesting stuff just really residing around here because those are saturated, yeah? Those plates are saturated to specialists. So something I would encourage you think in an interdisciplinary way. So today, rather than talking about those guys, I'm going to talk about studies around here because that's very special to my group. Okay, part two, how to live long. There's a three way. You're lucky there, you're going to find out how to live long. Eating less, drinking red wine, having a hot bath. Sounds pretty good, apart from fast one, but I'm going to start with fast one. So there's a Japanese saying called hara hachibunme, which translates to very 80% full. And I remember my mom would, you know, I love eating. My mom would repeatedly say, Shinichi, you're eating too much, you know. You have to sort of hara hachibunme 80% to live long. And, you know, there's lots of circumstantial evidence for this. But clearly, I'm not listening to my mom so far. Yeah. But joke aside, dietary restriction for the prolonging lifespan is a serious sort of a scientific endeavor. And that goes back to, so this McCain Cromwell study, fed caloric restricted, those are rats, I guess, rats group lived 40% longer. That's like easy intervention, no? That's an amazing power. And what really got people excited there, it kind of works with yeast, C. elegans, fruit fly, and mice. And you know, if it works for all those species, this must be evolved. Really, like, you know, maybe the sort of like a rise of eukaryotes, you know? Then people really excited, would it work for humans or primates? And it works on primates, and people think, oh, it's gonna work on humans too, yeah? But actually, there was no meta-analysis on this topic, even though it was, we did a meta-analysis 2012, but there was no meta-analysis. But if you look into all those, you know, all those studies published in Nature and Science, yeah, all those things. But if you look at the Journal of, I don't know, Stickleback Research and all those, you find a paper which are not significant. So we wanted to put it together and see the, what's the variation, what's accounting for the, those variation. So we've done the meta-analysis 2012, and, sorry. And this is the result. I'm gonna explain this. Again, forest plot. I usually had a, it's missing smiley or a, so frown face is missing. So this is the log hazard ratio. If it's negative, it's better. It's a ratio between the hazard. Hazard is the rate of death. So rate of death is reduced for the experimental group. Overall, I think minus 0.5 is like 20 to 30% increase in your decrease in your rate of death, I guess, so, which is a good thing. But as you can see, those are 36 species, 145 studies, lots of effect size, but there's lots of variations, yeah? One thing I forgot was, I call them like model species, because those are the like 70% of studies are done, those guys. And there's other species, other, like, I don't know, 30-something species. Those are, like, minority. Okay? So if you get into those literature, they talk about, you know, oh, maybe all those, what they're finding is laboratory artifacts, because on the model species, you result actually shows it really works, regardless of female or male, death rate is decreased. But no model species results is weaker. And the people think, because in those laboratory species, they are like protected from the three P's, predator, pathogen, parasites, and the evolution, all the trade-off and everything changes. So I got the sort of like, you know, the support for this hypothesis, maybe laboratory artifacts. And there was another, how do you say, got controversy. They call it dietary restriction, but dietary restriction can happen in two ways. That is by reducing calorie or reducing actually protein. Actually, the amount of caloric value of protein and the carbohydrate is exactly the same. So without manipulating calorie amount, you can actually manipulate the amount of, you know, carbohydrate and protein, and how does it look like? So let's just concentrate on this one because it all shows a similar pattern. Red bits are, they are actually living the longest. How to read this? Caloric intake, 100% is a control group. Experimental group is reduced. So experimental group is eating about 50% of what the control group is eating. They're living longest. So it supports caloric restriction hypothesis, but the amount of protein is important, eh? Even though you are eating less calorie, if you are eating a lot of protein, your probability of death increases. And I'm really proud of this because this protein, they call it protein leverage hypothesis, this was just proposed, and empirical evidence was just a few species, but this is the power of meta-analysis because I put 145 papers together. Different paper actually use different amount of proteins, yeah? So if we put it together, we are able to generate this figure, and we were able to say protein is really important in the dietary restriction, prolonging longevity. Okay, so what does it all mean? Evidence for non-lab animals weak, protein restriction rather than caloric restriction. As you have seen, contour is much steeper here than this way. Both works. And most important, all Japanese mothers were kind of correct, yeah? Because if you reduce the calorie, you are usually reducing protein as well. And the caloric restriction works as well. So let's move on to the French paradox. How am I doing with time? So it's till 12:30? Yeah, okay, I have 30 minutes. I'm going well. Okay. So French paradox. Any French in the... Okay. So this is good for French. So the French people eat like rather, like not particularly a healthy diet, but they live much longer than British counterparts. I mean, they eat rubbish. So it might not be no paradox there, but they say the paradox is probably resolved by this here. Because red wine includes a stuff called resveratrol, okay? And the resveratrol, actually, if you go to your pharmacy, you can get the pill, and you can make, you know, that makes you feel younger. Is that really gonna work? It's already like, I think this figure was like several years ago. Now it's $1 billion industry. I would say probably, you know, has anybody bought this? Yeah, I found out my neighbor was buying this, and you know, no, you just think about it. So we did the, I guess, you know, because of that, but there's no meta-analysis of putting it together. If you go to like all this study, they will just highlight Nature or Science paper found, you know, resveratrol. If you feed resveratrol, mice will live forever or like, you know, 20-30% longer, but no meta-analysis. So we thought with my first master student, Katie, we done the meta-analysis and the results are here. So actually, overall, it seems to work, yeah? This is not touching zero. Death rate is reduced. But if you look at, you know, it works on nematode yeast, killifish maybe. This is an interesting fish, only live 2 to 3 months. But the maybe closest really to mice, you know, evidence is not really there. So some thoughts, resveratrol pills are unlikely to prolong your life, so don't buy the pill. I think there's a human trials on the way. Well, maybe it's nearly finished, like halfway, it's not looking very promising, so to say, human trial. Other potential benefit to resveratrol, so when we publish this, you know, when I publish Sparrow stuff, I wouldn't say nobody cares, but, you know, pharmaceutical company would not write to you, but we got the email saying like, you know, oh, we never said it's gonna prolong your life. That's gonna make you feel younger, yeah? So they were defending their stuff. We don't know that maybe resveratrol has other health benefits, which we don't know. So the most important part, live like Japanese, not French, is the conclusion. And you think I'm biased? Clearly I'm biased, but there's the one reason I'm telling it. I'm not biased. You look at statistics, yeah? Japanese always ranked as the longest living nation or population, and that's the only place that men actually can live over 80. And I was thinking, so I'm not following this hara hachibun me stuff, but there's one thing all Japanese people do, I think, is the taking a hot bath. I thought this was like all Asian culture, but it just seems like very particular to Japan. We just, since I'm childhood, I will go into like, you know, hot bath, I don't know, 42 degrees every day, 15 minutes or so. And that seemed to work. And it seemed to work so much, I think in Japan, like monkeys starting to sort of imitate our cultural behavior. And this is when we went with my son. It's summertime, so, you know, monkeys are not in a hot spring because it's too hot. This is one thing. This is very close to where I was born, the Valley of the Hell in Nagano. Very nice place to go. But the joke aside, there's a hypothesis called homeostasis. Yeah, you might have heard of it. Lifespan might be actually increased dose of stressor It doesn't matter this is psychological stressor, chemical stressor, physiological stressor, this homeostasis type thing really seem to work, okay? So we are testing this serious hypothesis, and so this is done by my partner. Can we live longer having hot baths? And we put all together those heat shock papers to see it actually prolongs the lifespan. And this is the result, bang on zero. What does it all mean? You can see that all of them are insects. Probably you couldn't get like an ethical permit for the bar tablets. We did find one Australian study with chickens, but like unfortunately all chickens sort of died, cooked. So we couldn't include it. It was a bit outlier, so we took it out. One thing is, again, it's lots of variation there. So wrap it up. So this was like, so if you expose, it's according to homeostasis hypothesis, if you put too much stress, they die. So that's no good. I mean, I can show this in meta-analysis. That's great. And what is important is you really have to find, if you put all data together, there's nothing, but there's certainly this sweet spot of window which can increase the longevity, yeah? Which very hard to find out. Actually, the really interesting thing was, do you know John Maynard Smith? He's a famous evolutionary biologist. He actually had a homeostasis Drosophila science paper, and he was able to show this effect very clearly. So he must have found this sweet spot. So conclusion, have a hot bath, don't overdo it, is the conclusion. Ask your Japanese friend what's the, optimal. So I'm gonna move on to the, I'm carrying on the, my sort of blaming moms or wisdom or mother series here. So I'm doing okay, actually. Can we always blame my mom? Wouldn't that be convenient? I do this anyway, but what can we blame? Eating too much? Of course I'm gonna blame her for this. She's a fantastic cook. Being lazy, I don't know, but also being stupid. And it turns out you could blame one of them to her. Okay, let's have a look at it. So there's a Baker's hypothesis. This is a really interesting hypothesis, is the, diet during a pregnancy, the womb may be more important than home. It's really, eating during a pregnancy or starving during pregnancy, they seem to have a huge health consequences later on. And it's actually made a big field in medicine. I even went to those conferences, medical science really onto this, because this is a prevention, eh? Because you get disease, it's a bit too late. If you can prevent disease, that's much cheaper. So this is the Duhad hypothesis. And there's a consistent association about, starving. There's a lots of data from, you might have heard this Dutch winter, Stalin, Leningrad, seizure, sort of like hunger. There's a Great Leap hunger sort of data from China. They consistently find those three things. So mothers during pregnancy, they're caloric restricted, or they're starved. And later on, kids become obese, diabetes, and also schizophrenia. And it seems to run not just intergenerational, transgenerationally. Yeah, probably some sort of epigenetic stuff is happening. I want to concentrate on those two first. Obesity mechanism. Yeah, how come mom gets stabbed? How come the offspring get obese? That doesn't make sense. Two hypotheses is the appetite. Maybe, there's some signaling happens and, the offspring become eating too much. They call it hyperphagia. A reasonable hypothesis. Another hypothesis is maybe offspring become very lazy. Yeah, this is coming from being lazy or eating too much. We tested those two hypotheses using literature. And of course you have to, there's no human literature there. You can't, actually there is, but it's all correlational, yeah? So to do meta-analysis, those experimental work are rats and mice, but there's hundreds of them. This is like a huge opportunity. Nobody's doing meta-analysis. So we can test those evolutionary hypotheses. Actually, the Baker's hypothesis is really the evolutionary hypothesis, yeah? And my partner again, she was a little bit concerned, you know, caloric restriction during pregnancy will like effects having an effect on the offspring phenotype, and also eating too much. So that's an interesting topic for a mother. And put a long story short, we didn't find any effects. So during, I mean, there's been, it's a reasonable hypothesis, mothers eating a lot or mothers eating less during pregnancy, that didn't seem to affect the appetite of the offspring, okay? Even though there's a lots of paper supporting this, what's happening here? And this is like, you know, again, the power of meta-analysis. What we realize is biomedical researchers do not know allometry. Have you heard of allometry? So allometry is basically if you, sorry, it's rabbit, it should be rats. But anyway, rabbits, you know the rabbits. And as they get bigger, food intake is not gonna go linearly larger, yeah? Food intake is usually has allometric relationship or a log-linear relationship. So when biomedical people were analyzing their data, they are always assuming the linear increase. What's the consequence of this? Consequence is, if you assume a linear relationship here, you kind of measure here, yeah? You measure here, it's exactly on the same line. If you log them, if you log transform, they're the exactly same slope, but if you don't log it, you actually get statistically significant different slope, and you conclude they are very different. And this mistake has been happening in hundreds of biomedical studies. So once you correct for it, all the effect disappears, almost all. Yeah. So that was the finding using meta-analysis. And this is Anne, she was postdoc, and she was pregnant at that time as well. So we were interested in another hypothesis. So maybe diet during pregnancy will not the appetite, maybe the personality will affect the coping style. And feasible hypothesis, there's some support, no support, and you know, all sorts of tests being done. You know, long story short, we didn't find anything. The only thing we found is like pretty reasonable. If you starve mother, like, you know, the offspring are very small, and he or she might not move very much because, you know, it's deprived, it's a pathological. But we didn't find anything. They're making similar sort of mistake I just mentioned. But, okay, does mom's diet restriction affect cognition? Finally, after like hundreds of negative stuff, I'm gonna tell you something positive or statistically significant for a change. So if you restrict the diet of mother, it actually does seem like reduce the cognition. So this is HSG is like mean difference. You can think as a difference in standard deviation or something. So half of this standard deviation reduced if you coming from, you do the cognitive test as like, you know, all sorts of those version test or learning test with mice with Skinner's box, yeah? And so, offspring of dietary strict mothers, overall performance worse. Well, something's happening here. Interesting. But even more interesting, and this was not known in the literature, again, the power of meta-analysis is, we separated, is that appetitive learning? Appetitive learning, whether you get food, yeah, as a word, or aversive learning, if you don't learn it, you will like, drown and die, yeah? So what do you think? Evolutionarily, which is more important? I think we would agree negative learning is more important, probably, because if you don't learn it, you're dead very immediately. So aversive learning more important survival than appetitive learning. This is a hypothesis, and it hasn't really talked about in the literature, so that's cool. Okay, so what? If you are eating too much, it's not your mom's fault, so don't blame mom. If you're lazy, you can only blame yourself, yeah? And if you are stupid, it may be it's mom's fault. Yay, yes. Mom knows what's best for you. Yeah, as we have seen, moms try not to, like, you know, evolutionarily try not preserve your negative learning ability, letting go. You know, it's a trade-off, something has to let go. If you are rodent though, yeah? If you are rodent, I'm not talking about us. So that is a part four. How am I doing with time? Okay, oh, 15 minutes, 14 minutes, that's, I'm not even going too fast. Okay, so meta-analysis, I've shown the power of meta-analysis. I'm going into the different kinds of field. It's very cool, yeah? Because biomedical research, hundreds of thousands of research done it for you. You just come up with the evolutionary hypothesis and you can test. But meta-analysis, that's not gonna cover everything. You might want to do research synthesis. So I'm gonna talk about a recent paper we published in Trends in Ecology and Evolution. That's sort of, I call it, kind of new paradigm for the research synthesis. So I talked about systematic review and meta-analysis. Systematic review bit is like, you know, you do literature search in a defined manner, so it's not biased. Meta-analysis you've seen, this is like a real forest plot. Usually you get the effect size from different studies, and you use different statistical model to get overall effect. Does this mean we can only include in meta-analysis that empirical paper? But what about those theoretical paper, opinion piece, all other reviews? What we're gonna do that, you know, we want to like synthesize everything. And this is where mapping comes, yeah? And this is systematic mapping, first time, or they call it evidence mapping. This was the first time I came across. Why, it's always Nature, but Nature published the good stuff. This is, it's not long time ago, I saw this cool stuff. So what it is doing is, they took all the studies about, you know, conservation, intervention, and the human well-being. There's thousands of them or something. But you can see by categorizing by the topic, you can see the gaps in the research and what we call the research cluster or GLUT. And this will make, you know, make you sort of identify what's the hot topic, where we can do the meta-analysis. So this was like the most hot topic, and zoom in, that was research management, economic living standard. Zoom in, most of study done in India, that's interesting, and that's a mapping, and what biome they've been studying. That's a nice new way of doing research synthesis. That's quite cool, I thought. And so that's, let's not worry about this. So systematic review and meta-analysis, we are usually asking what works or what's general, and we only deal with primary study and empirical study. Primary is you know, research, secondary is reviews, yeah? But the broad synthesis, like systematic mapping, last example, just they were focusing on primary and empirical, but that's, we don't need to restrict that. We can actually deal with all the sorts of things to capture in the one topic what kind of papers are published. So that's what's studied, okay? But this is sort of, you know, for the sake of completeness, you can actually do the meta-analysis or meta-analysis. It's very rare. But that's a sort of topic for another time. But most interestingly, bibliometric mapping, you can use exactly same sort of like a publication, but you can get very different information. So let's think about those, focus on those two. Before that, I want to teach you that there is a three way of this bibliometric mapping. So you get a bit of the basics. So there's a three ways of how publications are connected. This is a social sort of network analysis type thing, you know? Papers are connected as well, not just humans and animals. Direct citation, this makes sense, yeah? Your paper is cited by another paper. But actually, in the field of bibliometrics, they don't really use this. This is a recent development. Actually, oldest is what we call bibliometric coupling, that's why STAR. This is interesting. So you have a group of papers, just say two papers, how many references are shared, bibliometric coupling. And you can see this gets lots of connections in the papers in one field. And this co-citation is a sort of flip of this, is like, you know, third paper citing both papers, okay? And the different sort of analysis require different number of papers. You don't need many papers in here. You need a little bit more, you need a lot. So I'm visual, so the example, This is direct citation. I don't know what's the topic, but you can see that there's two key papers there. So you can see the ontogeny of the whole field, yeah? And this is a fantastic, you should check out the Internet Shape of Science project, all the publication in the Scopus, not the Elsevier Scopus. And you can see the shape of science is a donut, okay? And if you pay attention, there is a tooth sticking out. It's a dentistry, if you can read it. So this actually uses three different kinds of all the citation network, and it's average of it, okay? Okay, here are what I'm suggesting. So research weaving, this is a new framework, but it's kind of fancy, but it's nothing like really fancy about. So evidence synthesis is what we call systematic mapping or review. Systematic maps of evidence synthesis does include meta-analysis as another layer. But from systematic maps, you can see the what content, what type of studies done, what type of, you know, is that observational study, theoretical work, what's the reviews done, what the animals being studied. Bibliometric maps are what we want to call webs because it makes, you know, social network analysis. Network analysis, isn't it? Direct citation, causal network, term connection. Yeah, you can do the coad analysis. Coad analysis? Yeah, co-term analysis. You know, how many words are used repeatedly among the sort of like a group of papers. And some of the information is similar, temporal trend and the spatial trend, where it's been published or studied. So I want to call it research weaving. So new way of. So actually what's really surprising is because those two stuff are developing at different places, those are actually mainly the social sciences, medical science, those are the actually information library sciences. So there's a very few study, if at all, there's no papers or reviews integrating those two. So huge area for you to like explore. And you know, how many papers we need, I talked about a little bit. You know, systematic review meta-analysis, you need 10 to 100 papers. Systematic mapping, it's because it's asking a broad question. You might not have even hypotheses, it might be exploratory. You need 50 to 500. Bibliometric mapping, basically is a bibliometric analysis, you might need a lot. But it kind of depends on the, what type of analysis you want to do too, yeah? And you remember this meta-analysis. So I wanted to like reanalyze. So this was done really systematic review, meta-analysis tradition. We would just, you know, this is the forest plot. But if I add those new bibliometric analysis, if we do the research weaving of this paper, what extra insight did I get? And this is how it looks like. So we stopped for this paper. We stopped like search in 2009, but it's clearly increasing. We should really update because it's really taking off, yeah? Now if I do it, some results may change, you know, something we couldn't test, lack of power maybe able to test. So I want to return to this meta-analysis. And you can actually see the Americans are obsessed with all the dietary restriction. Nobody seems to care apart from the, oh, Japan a little bit, yeah, because we think about eating less and all that. And it's really, it's not very healthy stuff. It's like, you know, it's only two groups. It's actually this Australian group there, Rob Brooks, Alex, supervisor. But this is like a big two groups are doing it. And I wanted to sort of like analyze those two groups are sort of publishing like conflicting result might not. Term analysis, which journalists publish. So you get more nuanced or deeper insight with collection of paper. Interestingly, systematic review meta-analysis community used to discourage this because we, you know, all data is the same. We shouldn't worry about, you know, whether it's coming from Oxford or some other, you know, universities. But I think, you know, adding all those bibliometric information will really enhance any type of review. Okay, I'm concluding my talk. So combining evidence synthesis, which is systematic reviews, what we are doing, including meta-analysis and inference synthesis, that is the bibliometrics. So bibliometrics include H-index, total citation, all those things, you know, the administration people want to use. But that's not all. You can do those web, you know, collaboration network, all other things, the bibliometrics. And those can actually, you know, the number of citations is interesting because, you know, you can quantify what we call citation bias. Some of paper may be cited despite actually it's, you know, it doesn't really have a strong evidence or something. Those things are all unexplored. So it's a huge field ahead of you. Evidence synthesis traditionally avoids information authorship. So as I said, meta-analysis usually don't want, like medicine discouraged to include this kind of stuff. Interestingly, but I've shown you, if you include those, you get the extra insight. Research weaving can better identify, so those combining two fields can identify research biases, gaps, and limitations. So you might have meta-research, that's the emerging field, research on research. This is a fantastic tool or fantastic concept, yeah? Visualization. So, you know, I've shown the lots of visualization. Networks and all analysis is done by visualization. So this will facilitate, you know, reaching to policymakers, practitioners, or the member of public. I'm nearly finishing. Acknowledgements of my lab in New Zealand. I was there till 5 years ago, then lab in Sydney. Since I have a few more time, I'm gonna advertise two things. So actually the PhD, I guess experience in PhD is important because I didn't really get any significant results and all those things. I got into the movement of open science. I was very much interested. And one of the things I recently led creating the preprint server called EchoWeb Archive. Probably people have come across BioArchive. How many people use that? And people would say, oh, we have BioArchive. We don't really need another one. But I would say BioArchive is just the one. You know, it's always good to have a choices, you know? You know, you don't want to just Google to dominate the world, but, you know. So we created EchoWeb Archive for, this is domain specific for ecology, evolution, conservation papers. One of the actually strengths is this is under the open science framework. Have you heard of open science framework? That's really fantastic resource. I don't have a time to talk about it, but you should check it out, OSF. That's really the nice research managing system, which was developed by Center for Open Science for our research make it available for the larger audience. So all the research can be stored there. You can incorporate Dropbox, GitHub, everything you can think of, Google Drive. You can share with everybody. You can keep it private. You can make it public when it's all published. So it's integrated this OSF, so please do consider submitting your preprint here. And yeah, we have a web page and Twitter and all those things if you're interested. Yeah, quite cool name, yeah. And another thing, so since this place is like, you know, that do lots of animal behavior, next International Society for Behavioral Congress is in Melbourne, which is next door to Sydney. And actually the society gives out in the past, almost 100% student traveling grant and early postdoc. So do apply and do come, it's gonna be fantastic. And thank you very much.